Trying to make Jacksonville a safer city. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross, and thanks for being with us. Just ahead this Monday morning, a look at the city's latest effort to bring down high crime rates in Duval. Can this one do the trick? Well, we'll find out what's being planned, and we want your calls, too. Give us a call right now at 549-2937. Then later, it's a First Coast success story as we profile Janet Owens of Lisk. Plus, the music of Pink Martini, they're in town tonight. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, the city's newly formed task force on safety and crime reduction, charged with combating violent crime in Duval. Well, it really has its work cut out for it. And what they're learning is that to bring down crime rates, the city of Jacksonville needs to finally get serious about addressing a longstanding issue, poverty in some parts of town. David Bauerline of the Florida Times Union covered the task force first meeting on Friday, and he joins us now with more. David, always good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. Here's our question to callers on this Monday morning. Are you familiar with all of the efforts over the years to bring down crime in Jacksonville? Remember the Jacksonville Journey, for example? Well, there's a new effort, a new task force. As parts of this city are literally crying out for help, gun violence plaguing so many areas of Duval County, and we want to know your questions and comments. What do you think needs to be done to address crime in Jacksonville? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we welcome your comments on Facebook as well. All right, David Bauerline, let's begin by learning what happened at this first task force. Who's on the task force, by the way, and what did they discuss on Friday?
Yeah, it's just an opening meeting. The task force is mainly made up of community members, people from nonprofit sectors, people who've been involved at the grassroots. There's also representatives of the expected entities you would have as far as state attorney, public defender, city of Jacksonville, city council, the mayor's office. It's 46 members, and they have a large mandate. They are really going to try and come up with wide-ranging recommendations for how Jacksonville, going forward, short-term, long-term, can find a way to break the grip of this violent crime that has been a factor in this city for decades.
That's right. We've been the murder capital of Florida off and on now for almost 20 years. And according to the latest crime statistics from FDLE, crime is up slightly over the last several years. We aren't seeing a downturn despite more police on the streets, a renewed focus on this. Why is it so difficult for this city to get its arms around this problem?
That is the fundamental question This task force is going to have to answer. You could argue that there has been a little bit of an off and on. The Jacksonville Journey you mentioned was a large community-wide effort, did a lot of good, ran into budget issues because the whole city was facing budget issues, got curtailed. That seemed to have at least a correlation, if not a causation, in terms of the violent crime going down and then coming back up when the funding went up and down as well. I think it's, you know, there's some deep-seated issues too, which I think this task force is going to look at. And I thought the fact that they're going to look at poverty, it sounds like, and economic conditions in the neighborhoods does add a new dimension that the city has not looked at previously in terms of what does it take to make long-term changes that are going to create the conditions that you have a safer city for these parts of the city that really have been weighed down by this violence for so long.
That's right. High rates of joblessness, lack of opportunity. Kevin Gay of the nonprofit Operation New Hope calls zip code prisons in this city. Operation New Hope is a group that tries to help people leaving incarceration find jobs. And by the way, that's part of what the Jacksonville Journey was trying to do as well, help people get a job once they came out of prison, help kids find after-school programs to keep them occupied and off the streets. But zip code prisons in parts of Duval County, where you know, if you are growing up in a certain zip code, your chances of getting shot are up dramatically. Your chances of finding a good job are low. Your educational opportunities are limited at best. And so, you know, to get serious about poverty in Jacksonville, David, means really dealing with the socioeconomic conditions in the northwest side of the city primarily that lead to this poverty. Dealing with early childhood education, for example, because, you know, from birth to age five is when the brain development of children is so critical. And a lot of kids aren't getting the support that they need and the early childhood education they need to even be competitive in school. We're talking about half the kids in this county that are on free or reduced lunch. I think it's even more than half now.
Right.
I don't think people realize how serious the poverty is. I don't think people really see it, you know, unless they really work in the neighborhoods. They don't know.
I think that's right. And I think even if you look at the data, you see zip codes that are doing the best in Jacksonville, and you put it side to side with zip codes that are doing the worst. The zip codes in Jacksonville doing the worst are not just the worst in Northeast Florida. They're some of the worst in the entire state. And it's been that way for a long, long time. And you mentioned, Melissa, just the likelihood of being shot. It's also the likelihood of growing up in a neighborhood where you're more likely to see that violence firsthand, to see the police tape up as you're walking to school or driving to work, just going through the neighborhood. And so there's a matter of this trauma that's has a lasting impact. I think that's something that people have been looking at more and more. So yes, it is something that's deep-rooted. It's something that would take a lot of work. It's something that we'll see whether there's a full range of recommendations that come out of this task force. If so, what would it cost and how much of a political appetite or will is there to take that on?
Exactly. As you pointed out, the Jacksonville Journey was robustly funded under the John Payton mayoral administration, and it was starting to work. It was starting to have an impact. Then the financial crash hit and a lot of its initiatives got defunded. So is Jacksonville ever going to set up a dedicated funding source to deal with these problems, to deal with crime and the root causes of crime? Is there the political will for that? You and I have been covering this for some time now in this city. The cynical answer would be no, there probably is not the political will for that.
To have a dedicated funding source. I haven't heard anybody make the case for it and stake out why that would be helpful. Even under the Payton administration, if you look at what they were doing, they had plans over a five-year period through the Jacksonville Journey to really ramp up spending on the Journey programs. That didn't happen under Payton either. I mean, he faced the realities of the recession. Funding stayed level. Then it started to taper off. So the city has never really fully funded what was envisioned for the Jacksonville Journey. Even today, if you wanted to do what they had planned, you'd probably have to double funding for these programs that were cited by the Journey. As far as the dedicated funding source, you know, you could do, it would be like I've heard the talk about a half mil. That might be about what the city is spending right now on the Jacksonville Journey. The issue there with the dedicated funding source is you know it's there. You know it's going to go up as the city's tax base goes up. It's going to be automatic. You can do long-range planning. There's a foundation there that's not given to year-to-year fluctuations in the political budget.
And as you reported in the paper Friday, the sheriff's office investigated 109 murders in 2017, a projected 110 murders in 2018. Other crime rates are up, although nonviolent crimes are down. I'm generalizing a bit here, but just looking at your story, you also reported that public defender Charles Cofer told this task force that the sheriff's office is doing a good job overall, but that we need to build on that momentum to go after gang-related violence, fighting poverty in the city, and getting more young people in high-crime areas mentors and activities to keep them away from gang activity. You know, police don't even like to talk too much about gang activity in this city. They don't want to give too much credibility to gangs, but that's part of this too, isn't it?
It is. And if I can just go back to the statistics, I mean, the statistics the sheriff's office showed to that task force would show that when you look at violent crime, which is murders, rapes, robberies, aggravated assault, aggregated, there's been some improvement in 2018 compared to 2017. Now, that's not to say that there's a drastic improvement and you shake it all out and it's not much different from what it was in 2016. Now, there's been a lot of debate in this political season about the crime rate, the statistics on the crime rate. I know there's been Anna Brochet's campaign has talked about a Curry crime wave. A crime wave really is a sudden spike in crime. I don't think Jacksonville's had that. On the other hand, you had a mayor who ran for election almost 4 years ago on a vow to make the city safer and drastically bring down the crime rate. That hasn't happened either. So the statistics seem to show that, in general, it's just more of the same. We're having the same kind of violence. If you get the property crimes, they've been going down for years. They were going down under the Brown administration, under the Payton administration, and still going down. So you're less likely to have a car broken in or your house burglarized. That's a great thing.
Sure.
But in terms of those areas of the city, and this is what Charles Cofer, the public defender, was talking about, that have this long-running problem with crime, it goes very deep, and if the solutions are going to have to go likewise deep in terms of tackling on those underlying conditions that create the atmosphere or this thought in too many people, they've got nothing to lose by committing acts of violence.
And as you said, this task force is ramping up just as we have an election in March, where the mayor, the sheriff, and other officials are on the ballot, and public safety is issue number one.
Right. It definitely is. That seems to always be the case. I mean, it's one of the biggest things the city spends money on. That's always been the case. Certainly, when you look at Duval County, Jacksonville, there's a perception when people move to St. John's County that it's a safer place to live, even if the statistics would show that a lot of Duval County and Jacksonville is perfectly safe as well. So it applies to a lot of different ways in the future of the city in terms of individual safety, neighborhoods, and also just the general growth of Jacksonville.
All right, let's go to your calls now. As we speak with David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union about the new task force on crime reduction in Jacksonville, it is just getting going. This is by far from the first effort in Duval to fight crime and bring down high homicide rates and high rates of gun violence. We have been in Florida's murder capital for the better part of 20 years now. What do you think about that? Give us a call, 549-2937. Stanley is in downtown Jacksonville right now. Hi, Stanley. Good morning. Happy Monday to you. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm opposed to the task force. I'm at most of the meetings when it comes to crime prevention in Jacksonville. And we keep bypassing one of the most important components, and that's leadership. Jacksonville is absent of leadership. Holistically in this city here, especially when it comes to crime prevention. And I'm a member of the African American Economic Recovery Think Tank, and we are opposed to this task force because it's the same old, doing nothing.
Well, wait a minute. Let me ask you, what then should be done? What do you think should happen?
Well, first of all, we have a group of community leaders that's not at the table. We have already worked out what needs to be done to decrease the crime in Jacksonville. I've been reaching out for almost 4 years to, no, 3 years to Assistant Chief Waters, which is supposed to have been over crime prevention. You do not get any input from the Sheriff Department. The Sheriff Department, no matter what information you provide to them to reduce crime, they overlook it.
Like what? Give me an example.
Well, first of all, one of the main things you can do in the urban core community, you need to take those kids and them parents out of those community on the weekends. Jacksonville is a big city. We got some of the best parks in the country. And we are not being exposing our assets. We have a lot of good assets in this city that we are not using that a lot of people in the underserved community need to be exposed to change their mental environment. And they do not get that opportunity because we are not exposing them. we're not using the resources we have. Every time I hear somebody talking, they're talking about dollars. Everything is not about dollars. It's about a civic and social engagement.
All right. And I think I hear your point. And in order to do those kinds of things, we're talking about everything from better transportation to mentorship. Yes. Lots of factors to that. Thanks for that call. Now, let me ask you, David. Part of this task force is calling for these kinds of things, mentoring kids, providing more activities for kids, getting the business community more involved. That was part of the Jacksonville journey, too, as I recall.
Right.
This isn't a new idea.
Yeah, and I know some people are cynical about another task force, and I understand what people say. I personally think that these types of community-wide meetings and discussions and debates are good for just that reason, in terms of being able to mobilize all those resources. You know, I've been covering Jacksonville now for 20 years, and every year the Chamber of Commerce goes on a trip to another city to get best practices of what other cities are doing. And they always check out what downtowns are doing, and they come back invigorated. They come back with ideas. Public officials are on those trips. They're more likely to support it. It's been a year in, year out consistent effort. I may be missing something, but I don't know that that's something that these Chamber of Commerce trips go say, every year we're going to go check out a neighborhood that has been left behind and find out what the city is doing to bring that neighborhood back into the mainstream of economic growth and prosperity. That's part of what getting the business community involved is, beyond obviously the philanthropic and approach to it. Mentoring, you know, the thing about mentoring the business community is that the state attorney came out with a report in conjunction with the sheriff's office and mayor, and basically said the best mentors are people who come from the communities themselves.
Right.
I'm not sure that somebody who lives in a different neighborhood is going to be able to parachute in and be a really, really effective mentor for some of the young people who face really tough issues. It can't hurt. It's good. But a lot of what needs to be done is fostering mentors who come from the communities themselves and can really have authentic relationships with people who need them, especially young people.
Sure. 549-2937 to join us. Bonnie at the Beaches. Hello, Bonnie. Go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you. I just want to talk a little bit about the numbers that are being reported. You know, we're focusing on this murder number, and we say murders have gone down. But what is not being talked about are the number of deaths that occurred out of violent incidents that are not classified as murder. There have been over 374 deaths in Duval since Curry was elected. Some are classified as justifiable homicides, but they stem from a violent incident, and some are not yet classed. There are a number of murders that have not yet even been classified as murder or homicide. So when we move those out of the equation, things might look a lot better when we classify those maybe as aggravated assault or some other type of crime. And it doesn't really give you the sense of what's going on in the community. And I also want to say, to me, both things can be true. The police can be doing a good job at reducing crime, and we can be experiencing a crime wave at the same time. If we have to settle for a crime wave being a spike from where we currently are now to something higher, then what we're doing is accepting where we are as a norm. And to me, that's not a good place for the city to be. And so that's some of my points. We have to look at the whole picture and not just try to make it look better around election time.
Thanks for that, Bonnie. Okay, she's right about that. And your own publication, the Times Union, has reported on that as well, David. And should we be looking at this task force through the prism of politics? Is this being done to make City Hall look better leading up to an election?
I don't think that's the case. I will say that the statistics on murder that were given to the task force show that there were 106 murders in 2016, 109 murders in 2017, and they expect that 2018 will have 110 murders. That's not a decrease. That means it's about the same for all practical purposes. So just want to get that point out in terms of the data. In terms of whether it makes the administration look good or is political, look, I think you can make an argument that if you are trying to that a task force that highlights crime is an issue that the city still needs to solve, that still remains a problem. That's not necessarily politically helpful to Lenny Curry as he runs for re-election. He has said he supports the task force. He has said himself that he's not satisfied with where things are and that the city has a long way to go. So I don't think there's a feeling that right now the city is where it needs to be or should be satisfied or content with the level of violence that still persists.
549-2937. AJ is on the line from Mad Dads, local organization working in neighborhoods to address these issues. AJ, good morning. What does Mad Dads have to say about this?
Good morning, Melissa, and your guests. I think what's missing from the equation with most of these violent crimes, it's affecting our young people, so we need to figure out how to get them more engaged in the process to tell what they know. I think last year we had 69% of the murders that wasn't cleared, and young people engage with us on our social media every day, so they know a lot of what's going on, but they're not telling it. So the task force needs to figure out how to engage the young people to tell what they know to reduce the crime in our city. I think that's the key.
Okay. And how should they do that? What, you know, because nothing that's been tried up till now has worked so well.
I think you have to use the platforms that they engage in. Mostly they engage in social media a lot, Instagram, places like that. You need to do more community events where we can get the young people out, park events, bring out gaming trucks, have basketball tournaments, anything that would engage the young people to bring them out so you can have them in an isolated place where you could talk to them and share with them.
Sure. Okay, that's AJ of Mad Dads. Thanks for that call. Yeah.
Yeah, Sheriff Williams, when he talked to the task force, talked about how you can't arrest your way out of it, how basically when they law enforcement gets involved, treating symptoms, not the root issues. I'd be interested to hear from the sheriff's office, from the task force, what are the root issues? I mean, the sheriff's office is engaged on a day-by-day basis investigating crimes. They also have some programs where they identify people who are, quote, gang members, talk to them on a one-on-one setting about the choices they face, try and convince them to take a different path. They are hearing directly from the young people that Mad Dad's caller is talking about. Mm-hmm. They would know, and they probably should be able to share some really good insights so that you can't figure out what are these root causes.
Lots of emails and tweets. Here's one from Daylin. We need affordable, safe housing in this city. Currently, rent rates are very high in safe neighborhoods, $1,400 a month. That is certainly part of the equation. Thanks for that email. Transformation Jax tweets the show, what is the church's role in combating this city's spike in violent crime? Young people we need to reach don't have much faith. Yeah, there are some faith leaders on this task force, but thanks for that tweet. And here's another tweet from Chad. He's actually running for office. This is a tweet from Chad for Jax, Chad McIntyre, running for city council. Few of the recommendations of the 2006 JCCI study were implemented on this. Council's neighborhoods, community services, public health and safety committee. There was no initiative going forward. Investment must be sustained for a generation. Right. That gets back to what you and I were talking about earlier. To get really serious about this, there needs to be a long-term commitment over many different mayoral administrations, a generational commitment to really turn this around, David. Instead, we've seen a lot of short-term efforts.
Right. So there's a lot of references or comparisons made to the Better Jacksonville Plan, which was a huge public works initiative, did a huge number of things across the city, and saying that's the kind of multi-year thing you have to do to really change the dynamic in parts of the city that do have the worst crime and the least amount of, quite frankly, the least amount of hope in a lot of ways about what the future is going to bring.
Jim is in Avondale. Hi, Jim. Thanks for your call. Good morning.
Thank you, Melissa. This is Jim Love, City Councilman, District 14.
Oh, hey, Councilman Love. Good morning.
Good morning. I've always said, and I'm going to sign up for take stock in children here this next school year, and I think mentoring is the key that could be multi-generational. And I believe that either the city or the school board should take charge and really push it. And the city could do it by offering 1 hour a week. That if you go to school and mentor, that you get that time off to go do that. I'm going to do it. I've done it before. I think many more people should do it. Charlie Cofer says it's the right idea. It's the second item on the task force idea. If we get a lot more people doing it on a regular basis, year in and year out, I think over a long term, we can make a big change.
Absolutely. And Councilman, let me ask you as a follow-up what David Barreline, my colleague here, just said about people comparing this effort to the Better Jacksonville plan. Do you think that type of long-term sustained effort is needed? And would you support that on the city council?
Well, I would support a long-term sustained effort as long as it didn't break the bank.
Right.
And that's always been an issue. And that was the issue for the demise of the previous programs we had. So we need something that's affordable. I personally am, it's not going to cost a nickel to get me to go or anybody else to go for 1 hour a week. And I've done it. I know it makes a small difference. And over a long period of time, it make a huge difference. I hope that many people will sign up for mentoring. I, for one, am planning on doing it. I'll be out of office, so I have plenty of time to mentor to some young people, probably in middle schools, when I'm on a target, I hope.
Well, you're absolutely right. It does make a difference, and lots of people could commit to that, a small commitment. And if a lot of people do it, it can make a significant impact. That's City Councilman Jim Love calling in. Councilman, always great to talk to you. Thank you for sharing your thoughts, and keep in touch with us.
Will do.
Thank you for that. David Barreline, we've had one meeting of this task force and more to come. Anything else we need to know?
Well, they're going to meet again in 2 weeks, and then they're going to break up into small groups. I do think it has the potential to create some real differences in the long run. As a reporter, I'll be following the thing we've just been talking about, which is this going to be low-hanging fruit, the kind of thing that's not really a large expense? Or is this going to be something that comes out and says, look, there needs to be some real large-scale investment over a prolonged period of time if you really want to reverse this in the long run and finally get rid of this murder capital of Florida tag that a lot of people say is, you know, some people say, well, it's not right, it's not, yeah, it's not
but,
true.
It is accurate,
statistical of what it's like in Duval County.
And go to jacksonville.com to read more of David Barreline's excellent reporting on this. Always good to have you on the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Still ahead, sports with Cole Pepper, but up next, singer China Forbes of Pink Martini, a preview of their show tonight. That's next. We'll be right back. First Coast Success is brought to you by Iberia Bank. Well, she runs a local nonprofit that's made a huge impact in some of Jacksonville's most challenged neighborhoods. In today's First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis, editor of the Jacks Daily Record, speaks with Janet Owens of LISC.
Janet Owens is the executive director of LISC Jacksonville, an affiliate of the National Local Initiative Support Corporation. In that role, she has helped to finance some major Jacksonville projects, such as the Florida State College at Jacksonville Downtown Residential Apartments for students. Her career includes work with Volunteer Jacksonville, which became Hands-On Jacksonville, the Girl Scouts of Gateway Council, and United Way of Northeast Florida. Janet Owens, Thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen.
Janet, what is your mission with LISC Jacksonville?
The mission of LISC Jacksonville is to transform and build healthy communities from communities that have been disinvested and to make them places where people want to live, work, play, do business, and raise their family.
Well, what drew you to LISC? You've had a long career in Jacksonville in the nonprofit and advocacy arena.
I've had some great career opportunities here in Jacksonville, but I had always had this desire to be more involved with helping the economic and destiny of neighborhoods and people in communities of particularly of color, but those that are not on the forefront of the major political scene, to help them be able to be viable. I happened to grow up in the city of Greenville, South Carolina, went away to college and came back, and the mayor at that time was a gentleman who'd retired from running a major shirt manufacturing company and had committed himself that he was going to help Greenville become the city of his, like the city that he'd grown up in, which was Vienna, Austria. He was a Holocaust refugee and also happened to be a good friend of my dad. So when I was looking for work, he actually hired me for the city of Greenville, and that was kind of where I cut my teeth on community development, helping in neighborhoods, learning and understanding and listening to citizens to hear their issues, and then seeing how we as a city could respond and invest in a way that would make them successful.
What would you say has been one of the most personally high-profile projects that you've worked with?
Well, most recently, it has been the Steps to Success Financial Opportunity Center, which is based in the Newtown area. And the joy of that was it was quite a journey for us to collect the funds that would make it possible to do that work and find the partners who were willing to join with us. And that's been so exciting to work with Lutheran Social Services, Family Foundations, United Way, who are all joining us in this vision, and a large voice from the Newtown Success Zone community in helping identify how this program could really advantage residents in that neighborhood, but also make sure that they were connecting people into the organization. The other project that I would say was our most recent foray, well, not our most recent foray, but our big foray when I came into the New Markets Tax Credits world with the Jesse Ball DuPont Center development. We were thrilled to invest in that. And it allowed us to sort of cut our teeth on this work in such a way that made it possible for us to be invited to work with the Barnett Tower and the Laura Street Trio. We are working to move projects that are some of the most difficult, thorniest projects. And LISC has been doing that for almost 20 years. However, with the real estate crash and what happened to us in that 2008 to 2010 period, it has been so difficult to rebound. There were many tools in place through city government that complemented the approach that LISC takes in redeveloping neighborhoods and providing the financing or doing the technical assistance that we do. And those things did not come back, you know, as revenue, tax revenues decrease and needs that have been unaddressed for years have to be prioritized and come back to the fore. It has left a lot of the community development work on either a lower priority or on a very, very slow lead time. So we look for the opportunity to help our neighborhood partners and partners from across the city who are working to invest in neighborhoods to invest in a way that helps those deals get across the finish line.
And what would you consider to be one of the major successes of your career?
There are a couple that I am pretty excited about. I am thrilled that we were able to launch with the Northwest Jacksonville community, Springfield, and the East Side, the what we call the Epic Communities back in 2012, which was a 5 to 7 year plan envisioned by those residents to move the needle on a whole series of needs, from environmental needs to, we mentioned the Financial Opportunity Center, that's an outgrowth of that plan. Groundwork Jacksonville was an outgrowth of that plan. And we are really thrilled to see that many of the things that were envisioned there, such as a grocery store for Northwest Jacksonville, are all starting to move forward. And so that is one major success. The other, I would say, is most recently, I guess a couple years ago, we were working with Newtown and learned about the rail yard district, and we were able to work with the businesses there for them to come together around a common cause and agenda to build the it's already an economic engine, but to really come together to leverage that power that they have and to address some of the needs that will allow them, from infrastructure to physical development, zoning, all of those things that can potentially allow them to grow and be even more successful.
Janet Owens, Executive Director of LISC, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you for the opportunity, Karen.
And in a moment, the music of Pink Martini, where you can catch them tonight. That's next.
Full disclosure, I've always jokingly referred to my savings account as my Spice Girls reunion tour fund. And it became a reality that day when, like a crazy person, I bought tickets to all three of the American shows.
Join us for more true stories told live. Next time, it's all about the music. Stories from Motown, pop, hip-hop, and folk. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, Pink Martini draws inspiration from the genres of classical, jazz, and old-fashioned pop. This little orchestra, as they're called, performs here in Jacksonville tonight at the Florida Theater. I spoke about their show with singer China Forbes. Here's what fans can expect.
Thanks for being on the show. How you doing? I'm great. How are you?
Really well. And we're looking forward to your show at Florida Theater. It's amazing the fan base Pink Martini has built up all over the country. A really unique sound and multiple genres. Tell me a little bit about the band and the show.
Well, the band is anywhere from 12 to 500 people.
Yeah, it's a big group.
It's like sometimes 12. Most 12 core band members, but then we have guests and sometimes string sections, and sometimes full orchestras, you know, we play with. So, but the band is this group of a combination of classically trained musicians, jazz musicians, Afro-Cuban master percussionists. It's all over the place. And I got involved because Thomas Lauderdale, who started the band, went to college with me, and when he was trying to find a singer, he remembered our days in college collaborating on various hilarious musical endeavors, and he asked me to come to Portland from New York City to sing in the band, and that's how I got involved, and that was almost 25 years ago.
Wow, 25 years. You have a great vocals, and Pink Martini is sort of a blend of, I think, modern freshness, but it really evokes some of the big band and supper club era. Do you think that's part of the appeal?
I do. I think people in general are nostalgic, and this music, I think, taps into that. I think some people come and they say, oh, that's a song my grandmother used to sing to me to put me to sleep at night. And, you know, or they come with their grandmother, and both, you know, all three generations, the parent, the grandparent, the child, can enjoy the same music because it's so versatile and eclectic that there's really something anyone can, I think, connect to. So that's really nice to see. It's really nice to feel like we're bringing not only people together, but families together.
NPR's own Ari Shapiro has played with the band, too. Will he be playing at this show?
He's not at this show, but he takes all of his vacation days to come sing with us.
And that's pretty cool. With the end of the government shutdown, the Florida Theater had been offering free tickets to government workers for Pink Martini. But now that the shutdown is over, that I think you do have to get your tickets. But it's so worth it. It's going to be a great show. It's Pink Martini at Florida Theater, and China Forbes, the singer. Thanks so much for giving us a few minutes. Have a great show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
That's Pink Martini tonight at 8 at the Florida Theater. Here's a little Pink Martini to listen to. You can get a taste of tonight's big concert. And up next, Cole Pepper with a preview of this weekend's Super Bowl. We'll be right back.
Album Friday night at that party on Avenue A, where your skinhead friend passed out for several hours on the bathroom floor, and you told me you weren't that drunk and that I was your favorite salsa dancer you had ever come across in New York City. Eugene, my number on a soggy paper towel.
The 30th annual Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities is being held this week in Eatonville. I'm Ben DiBiase, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss Hurston's life and career and the event that celebrates her legacy. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Did you go see Wonder Woman a couple of years ago? Yeah, me too. I loved it, in fact. So I asked the director why she wanted to make it.
It's so fascinating. Like, why do we make films? Why do we do the things that we do? Ultimately, it all boils down to our attraction to story.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, director Patty Jenkins, and her next project, next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Let's talk about food.
Food is the DNA of who we are. Food is our history. Food is employment. Food is national security.
Chef Jose Andres says food is everything. We'll talk about his work during the shutdown, his humanitarian efforts in Puerto Rico, and more. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
The Wizard of Oz is turning 80. And the debate continues over what that movie means. Is it a parable on populism, a manifesto for feminists? Perhaps it's just a psychedelic trip with poppy fields and flying monkeys. The Wizard of Oz. Your questions answered next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. It's Super Bowl week, but there's something bigger at stake in Atlanta for Jaguars fans this weekend.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper is here to explain just what it is. I think it involves a local hero named Baselli.
That's the one. Good morning, Melissa. Super Bowl is Sunday, but Saturday, a big day. That's when we'll find out if Tony Baselli has made it into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. The former Jaguars left tackle is a finalist for the third time in a row. He's well received. I think at some point he's getting in. The question is when. Will he get in this year? At News 4 Jax, we had Mark Brunell sit down with Tony, his friend and former teammate, to talk about what it would mean for number 71 to become the first Jaguars player ever to wear the gold jacket.
It's the biggest honor I think you can have as a player. And so to have that happen, it would be special. It would mean a lot to me for this organization, because I think being a part of the organization, being the first pick, be able to represent it in the Hall of Fame, I think it would mean a lot for, I mean, like the teammates I played with.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'd want them all there and
it's
be a part of it.
Something we'd all get to share.
Yeah, I mean, that's the cool part for me. I mean, now listen, and individually, I'd rub it in your face all the time and making sure you understand that I am the Hall of Famer in this thing. Make sure you well, address me properly.
Those two, you know, have so much history together.
Oh, that's cute.
We had a lot of fun with that interview. It took about half an hour over the stadium with those two guys talking about it. And you just know that it means so much, and it would mean so much to Tony Baselli. But he also mentioned that it would be something where he and his former teammates could have something that, hey, I played with a Hall of Famer. And Mark says, yeah, that matters as well. As for Tony's chances, there are two slam dunk absolutely will be in Hall of Famers on the ballot this year out of the five possible spots they can go in. That's Ed Reed, the former Baltimore safety, and Tony Gonzalez, the former Chiefs and Falcons tight end. They will be Hall of Famers.
All right.
I think it's likely that Champ Bailey, the former Georgia Bulldog and Charlton County star, will probably get in as well. So now you've got two spots remaining for Baselli and others to contend for, and it's going to be interesting to see who winds up getting those spots again.
Well,
how
they tough only
select
is it
five.
In? I mean, this is his third nomination.
Yeah. So
how many is he? Are there people that are like the Susan Lucci's of this? They just keep getting nominated
sometimes,
but don't win.
Yeah. In fact, last year Jerry Kramer got in, and he had gone through the process and had spent as much time as he could as a candidate, and had to be put in by the senior committee. So sometimes it goes beyond sort of the selectors who meet in the room in Atlanta to talk about this. There are 15 finalists again, and only five of them will wind up as Pro Football Hall of Famers.
Well, good luck, Tony Baselli. That would be really exciting. All right, let's talk about the Super Bowl this weekend, which I think very few people here can get too excited about.
Given that the Patriots are involved.
Yeah. Are once again in the Super Bowl, which is so not good.
So repetitive. It is really remarkable. You know, last year I talked about how hard it is to beat Tom Brady in the Super Bowl, and then they lost to the Philadelphia Eagles. And you know, we've seen it happen three times before that Brady has lost in a Super Bowl. And I think the Rams actually have more talent on their roster top to bottom but I have such a hard time picking against Belichick and Brady in a big game. Again, I know it happens. We've seen it. But I'm taking the Patriots to win 27-24. I don't like it, but I just can't bring myself to pick the Rams, at least not yet. One interesting fact here for the game, the Patriots have nobody on their injury report. It's the first time in at least 5 years that a team has gone into the Super Bowl completely healthy.
Wow. So definitely the odds on their side, but what an upset it would be.
You know, I don't think
the Rams pulled this one out.
It would be a little upset. I think right now the Patriots are about 2-point favorites. The last I checked in terms of the line, the Rams have so much talent though. They've got the probable defensive player of the year on their team. They're loaded with talent. They also have the former Jaguar Dante Fowler, who the Jags traded during the season. So that's something to keep an eye on. And Jared Goff, the young quarterback, is certainly a rising star in the NFL, as is the coach Sean McVay, who is both obviously Goff is, but McVay is actually younger than Tom Brady, so by quite a bit. So this is a youth movement against the old guard, to be sure.
Last but not least, let's talk about the Pro Bowl down in Orlando now.
Yeah, for years it was in Hawaii. When the game was moved to Orlando, I thought maybe some players would think that it was a downgrade of some kind. They actually tell me that they like it because more of their family and friends can make it there than to make it to Hawaii. It doesn't cost them as much to fly them there, for instance. And Disney's there, and there's all that to happen during the course of the week. And after all, these guys, if they want to go to Hawaii, they can afford a trip to Hawaii just to get away. There were two Jaguars playing yesterday, Jalen Ramsey and Calais Campbell. Both made some big plays. Campbell had a sack. I'll call it a sack. It was really more of a gentle embrace because you don't really tackle in the Pro Bowl. It's not really a football game, witnessed by the fact that Jalen Ramsey went in at wide receiver at the end of the game and caught a touchdown pass. The AFC won, but I mean, who really cares about the outcome there. But those guys, I know they enjoy the week and the opportunity to be around some of the other great players in the NFL.
Now, before we let you go, you, Culpepper, are well known for your various manly barbecue stylings that you like to cook. What is on Culpepper's Super Bowl Sunday menu?
Well, as happened last year, I'll be working Super Bowl Sunday. So I can't put quite as much time in on the barbecue so it's probably going to have to revert to the often talked about and occasionally here in this building sampled man dip.
The Culpepper man dip.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that's in high demand.
It is. And
that's a manly dish.
It is. It's not for the faint of heart, and it's not really for your heart at all, as a matter of fact. But
it's basically meat, cheese, and more meat, as I recall.
Right, with a little meat on the side.
Yeah, but very good stuff. And follow Cole on Twitter at Culpepper. Maybe he'll even post the recipe before Sunday. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks a lot, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.